17. The Victorian building downtown turned out to be merely a substation with a sergeant in charge. DCI Sotomayor was to be found at police headquarters, which were situated on Rosia Road, about a mile north of town. Following the instructions they were given, Julie located Rosia Road, which angled away from Main Street and ran down toward the waterfront. "I think it's that building over there," she said, pulling to a stop.
"You mean the one with all the police cars out front and that big sign over the entrance that says, Royal Gibraltar Police Headquarters? You just might have something there."
"Very funny. Don't be tedious."
Laughing, he leaned over to kiss her. "We can't be more than half a mile from the hotel. I'll walk back. Think about where you want to have dinner."
"Let's just have it in the hotel with the others," Julie said. "I think it would be good to know what's going on. Also," she added with a smile, "I'm more comfortable when we have them all in sight."
"Okay. See you back there in an hour or less."
Getting out of the car, he found himself in an area of old buildings, mostly housing salty-sounding businesses, ship chandleries, nautical charts, marine hardware and coatings. The rusted street sign on the wall beside him told him that the alley at whose head he was standing was called South Dockyard Approach, and it led down behind him, predictably enough, to a sprawling dry dock operation. The two-story police headquarters building in front of him, like others nearby, was made of big, gray, rough-cut stone blocks. Above the Royal Gibraltar Police Department sign was an older one that said, "New Mole House," which suggested that the building had originally had something to do with the docks. Possibly, he thought, it had been the customs house. He guessed it dated from the early 1800s. Later, he was to learn that he was a century off. It had been built in 1904 as an office of the Ministry of Defense. The front entrance had been constructed as a porte cochere, an arched opening big enough to admit a large horse-drawn vehicle. A handsome gate of metal grillwork closed off the inner courtyard, a tranquil Spanish-style patio with ornamental cactuses and palms, enclosed by four white stuccoed balconied walls. Within the entryway vestibule, what had been the old gatekeeper's stall, was now a little office with a desk, behind which sat a smiling, crisply dressed young policeman, his starched white shirt and blue tie immaculate, his blue tunic draped with perfect symmetry over the back of his chair.
"How may I be of service, sir?"
"My name is Gideon Oliver," Gideon told him through the grated window. "Chief Inspector Sotomayor."
"Oh, yes, sir. You're to be fingerprinted and then escorted to the Chief Inspector's office."
He made a brief telephone call, then produced a visitor's badge, which was given to Gideon to be hung around his neck. No more than 20 seconds after he'd replaced the phone, another constable appeared at the gate, unlatched it, and took Gideon to a booking room, where he had his fingerprints rolled by a female constable, also white-shirted and blue-tied, who absent-mindedly hummed throughout the task. It took him a moment to recognize the tune. "It's a Small World After All."
"I understand you're some sort of scientific detective," she said, finishing up.
"Yes, you could say that."
"What do you detect?"
He pursed his lips, put his thumb and middle finger to his forehead, and put on a detecting expression.
"Tell me, been to Walt Disney World lately?"
Her jaw dropped.
"That's amazing. Disneyland, actually, in Paris, just last week. But how did you know?"
"Ah, we're not permitted to divulge our techniques."
His fingertips cleansed with a waterless cleaner, he was taken down a corridor to Fausto's office, which was on the ground floor, overlooking the courtyard. He was expecting something expensively furnished, carpeting, framed prints and posters, modern sculpture, to go along with Fausto's flashy, expensive taste in cars and clothes. But instead he found the Universal Cop's office. Linoleum flooring, scarred, unmatched furniture, most of it metal. Walls completely bare of decoration unless you counted charts, bulletin boards covered with overlapping notes and memos,
and maps with pins stuck in them. Shelves filled with codes and procedure manuals. Desk neat and almost bare. And no sculpture at all, modern or otherwise.
"Pull up a chair," Fausto said.
He too was in shirt sleeves, in his case silver-gray silk, shot through with pale gold stripes, the French cuffs of which had been turned back in two meticulous, clean-lined folds. His tie, diagonally striped in soft pastels, was, as always, a perfect match.
"Fausto, where do you get your clothes anyway?"
"Shirts from Prada, suits from Armani, ties Ferragamo. Why, you want to dress like me?"
"Are you kidding? I couldn't afford it."
"Sure you could. I get them over the internet. Doesn't cost as much as you think."
"Even so, I'm a professor. I'd never get away with looking like a mafia drug lord."
"You're right," Fausto agreed, preening a little. "It takes a cop to do that."
Gideon took the offered chair.
"So, tell me about the lamp."
"Not much to tell. They found the cord fabric and the wiring had both definitely been filed down,
to make it look as if they'd just frayed.
Unless you can come up with a better reason. They were even able to tell me what he used."
He glanced at an open writing pad on his desk.
"A steel, bastard-cut, half-round file, probably the 8 or 10-inch variety."
"Oh, is that any help? I mean, is that an unusual kind of file?"
"I was hoping the same thing, but nope, it's just a file. Find him in any DIY outfit."
"So where do you go from here?"
"First order of business is to try and match the prints on the lamp. We got 4 sets, okay? We already identified 3 of them, guys who had a legitimate reason for handling it. That guy Derek and 2 of his crew. That leaves 1 unidentified set. If yours match it, then we got pretty much bumpkiss. If they don't, well, I'm not sure what we have, but it's a place to start. Get prints from some of your pals to begin with."
"Uh-huh," Gideon said vaguely.
With 2/3 of his mind, he was still trying to put his finger on whatever it was that had been bothering him about the landslide.
"Listen, Gideon, are you sure it wouldn't be better if you had a little protection? There's no shame in it. I mean, now that we know for sure somebody messed with the lamp, that changes things, you know?"
Gideon waved him off and told him about Julie's hypothesis. The attacks on him had been motivated by fears about what he might be going to say, to reveal in his lecture. But now the lecture was over and done. Everybody knew there was nothing to reveal.
"You agree with that?"
"Yes, I do," Gideon said. "I still have no clue as to what they thought I was going to say, but I do believe that's what it was about, yes. And if you notice, nobody's tried to kill me since."
"Yeah, a whole 24 hours now."
"Closer to 28.
Fausto, what about Ivan? Are you getting anywhere with that?"
"Just getting started, trying to nail down the basic facts. We did a few preliminary interviews, just short ones, with the director at the museum, Roly, what's his name, Boyd? And with some of your friends at the hotel. Well, the one with the old fat guy, Vanderwater. That one wasn't so short. Pretty hard to have a short interview with him. That guy can really talk. But then I know Vanderwater. I should have set aside more time."
"How do you know Adrian?" Gideon asked.
"From the Sheila Chan thing. I did some of the interviewing when she disappeared. Mostly the same people who are back now."
"I don't understand. You said there was nothing suspicious about it. Why were you interviewing people?"
"Because the whole thing started as a misper, so..."
"As a what?"
"A missing person case, Britspeak. Nobody knew where she was for 2 days before we figured out to look at the cave-in to see if she was there, and she was."
"Oh."
Gideon could feel the gears of his mind engage again, and almost, but not quite, mesh. Sheila Chan, missing for 2 days. What was it about that that wasn't right, that didn't fit? She had been on his mind ever since the visit to the cave, and now he felt he was on the very edge of catching hold of whatever it was that was eluding him.
It was almost as if a snap of his fingers might flick it into focus. He snapped his fingers, twice. The thought, if it was a thought, stayed out of range.
Anyway, back at the ranch, Fausto said, looking at him curiously. Apparently this Roley guy got him out of there about 8 o'clock, because his mind was wandering a little.
So obviously was Gideon's. With an effort, he concentrated on what Fausto was saying.
That much is true enough, except that it was wandering a lot, not a little. By the time Roley got him out of there, it was back on Guadalcanal in World War II. Okay, so he gets him home to his cottage a little before 9, offers to make a pot of tea for him, but gets turned down. Gunderson says he wants to go to bed, and Boyd goes home himself. Gunderson, he says, was in an excited, confused state of mind. Now, we know the fire started around 4 a.m., give or take 20 minutes. So that means the attack happened sometime between 9 and 4.
Obviously. Probably a lot closer to 4, wouldn't you think? Gideon said. I don't see his killer hanging around for 5 or 6 hours after smashing his skull in before starting the fire. What about motive, Fausto? Getting anywhere there?
Nah. To hear them tell it, they all loved the old guy. Everybody loved the old guy.
Well, everybody I know did, Gideon said, including me. Maybe it was a stranger, you know, a robbery gone wrong.
Yeah, right.
Pretty unlikely, I admit. But was there any sign of forced entry?
Fausto laughed his rat-a-tat laugh.
Are you kidding? Maybe if any of the doors were still standing, we'd know. The damn place burned to the ground. All those solvents.
Right, I forgot.
The telephone on the desk chirped. Fausto punched a button and picked it up.
Anything? He listened for a couple of seconds. Shit. Thanks anyway, Rosie.
He hung up, grumbling.
The prints on the lamp. They're yours, all right, so no leads there after all.
Too bad, Gideon said, but his mind was off on its own again. The attempts on his life seemed long ago and trivial, hardly worth bothering about. Comic opera stuff, involving, as they did, broken-down old lamps and theories about homicidal monkeys. It was Sheila Chan that was eating at him. Something didn't fit about Sheila, or the cave-in, or both. And it was maddeningly, frustratingly, dancing around just out of reach. If he could only...
Fausto had returned to Ivan.
Boyd was able to give us a bunch of contacts that might turn up something. Gunderson's solicitor, his housekeeper.
Whatever was nagging at him necessarily had to be in the context of either what Fausto had told him during lunch at the Angry Friar the day before, or what he'd heard from Prue and Corbin at the testimonial dinner the night before that. Because that was all he'd ever heard about the cave-in and Sheila. That was his entire context. But it had been enough to set his antennae quivering when he saw the actual sight, the actual dirt of the landslide. Both conversations together couldn't have totaled more than 15 minutes. How hard could 15 minutes be to reconstruct? Start with Fausto. Fausto had told him, Julian Gideon, that he had been on the scene when she'd been dug out, that she'd been much crushed in the slide, that the maggots found on her indicated a time of death 2 to 3 days earlier, that some passengers on the Morocco ferry had seen...
The maggots! He cried,
practically jumping out of his chair. Fausto, caught in mid-sentence, blinked.
The what? The maggots! The maggots! Gideon repeated,
and this time he did jump out of his chair, waving his arms and striding excitedly around the room.
The maggots! He exclaimed yet again. How could I miss it? Where was my mind?
He whacked himself on the forehead, much as Kazimir Figluski had that morning, but harder than he'd meant to.
Ow!
Fausto calmly watched this extraordinary performance from his chair.
So, are you planning to let me in on this brainstorm anytime soon?
Gideon returned to the desk and leaned over it, supporting himself with both hands.
Fausto, she was murdered,
he said intently.
She!
Fausto threw up his hands. Oh, hey, give me a break, will you? Give it a rest already. We got this great record of one murder every 5 years, and you show up, and in one day, you're telling me about two murders that we never noticed? What, I don't have enough on my plate? I'm telling you, if you'd been around these last 5 years, I'd have had a homicide every other day. I mean, what is it with you? Every time you look at somebody dead, you...
Fausto, shut up and listen. She was not killed in the landslide. She was already dead when it happened. The cave-in was a cover, like the fire was a cover for Ivan.
You see, right there, that's what I mean, Fausto said with a pained expression. For you, any time there's a...
He sighed. Okay, all right. I know you're gonna turn out to be right. Just give me a minute to get used to it. I'm just, what do you call it, venting.
He sat there shaking his head, then laughed, a mixture of incredulity and amusement, and followed it with one more sigh.
All right, I think I can stand it now. Let's hear it. Tell me, why was she not killed in the cave-in?